25 minutes past the hour. It's a Thursday morning. We're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Earlier, I almost called you Pastor Robbie Pruitt.
I've been called worse. Good to be with you, Jim and David.
It wasn't intentional. If it's intentional, it's called a spoonerism. You know, it's like, pardon me, pat him by pink, you're in the wrong through. But it was an accident. It was an accident. It's Pastor Robbie Pruitt, Anglican pastor from the Commonwealth of Virginia, lives in Ashburn, and his church is in Leesburg in Loudoun County, right?
Loudoun County, western suburb of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital.
The hotbed of school district hot air.
We're not getting any news about the trucker convoy. Are they showing up in your neighborhood?
Oh, yeah. Well, not my neighborhood, but they were for sure around D.C. on Saturday and Sunday, and there were warnings issued in the area for traffic congestion.
Mm-hmm.
I actually visited a friend of mine in Arlington, picked him up from Reagan National Airport and took him into D.C., Pentagon City, and warned him about the trucker convoy.
That's called the loop. There's a circle around Washington, right? Because I got stuck on that one time, a long time ago. Now, I saw a news video of the trucker convoy. They were in the slow and center lanes. I mean, almost bumper to bumper. So I'm thinking, if you're in the fast lane, you're stuck there. You're not getting off that thing. How'd that work out?
No, well, I wouldn't know. I stay away from the Beltway. Well, that's what you're talking about. There's inside the Beltway, and then there's outside the Beltway.
Robbie is definitely outside the Beltway.
I think I would want to stay outside as far as possible.
Well, you are as far as possible outside the Beltway.
I am.
East Dakota. Robbie, we've been talking in the book of John here for some time, and it's great context. And one of the things that attracts me to John is he's so different from the others, from the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But I have a question for you on this one. And this relates to the synoptic Gospels. Chapter 11 of John talks about the raising of Lazarus, which is a great contextual story. And it would take up a couple of weeks to cover it all. But he purportedly came from down near Jericho, up to where Lazarus had been entombed by the time he got there, had been dead for 4 days, which in that culture means he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be that, well, 3 days, there's still a chance the spirit's hovering around, and conceivably, not likely, but maybe, he could come to life. 4 days, no way, no how. Jesus waited 2 extra days before coming. He must have had that in mind.
Yeah, so it's the nephesh is the spirit that hovers. The Jews thought that the spirit hovered over the body. And after 3 days, that nephesh was gone. Mm-hmm. So Jesus tarries to be sure that the Israelites know that the spirit had left. Elvis has left the building. The soul has left the body.
And he makes clear in a statement to Mary. He says, Jesus is dead, or Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there so that you may believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's like confirmation coming from the man himself. Lazarus was dead. And the point is, he was going to make a big deal out of this. And the big deal wasn't the raising of Lazarus, really. The big deal for Jesus was it was the final straw for the Pharisees and the religious establishment in Jerusalem, wasn't it? It pushed them over the edge.
It really is what gets Jesus killed. And throughout John's gospel, he highlights these provocative incidents, which provokes these religious leaders to want to kill him. John's gospel is just phenomenal. I mean, 80% of John's gospel, I mean, most of it is centered right around Judea, where in the synoptics, 80% of Jesus's ministry is the Galilee region, and it's focused on Jesus's life and ministry around Galilee. But John's gospel is almost the opposite. I mean, the majority of John's gospel happens in Judea and is written for Jewish audiences, and which is why, you know, Jesus has what's famously called the seven I am statements. I would argue that there's actually an eighth and maybe even more than that The famous seven are, I am the bread of life, in John 6. I am the light of the world, from John 8. I am the door of the sheep, from John 10. And then here, we're addressing in John 11, I am the resurrection and the life. Other I am statements, I am the good shepherd. I am the way, the truth, and the life, from John 14. I am the true vine, from John 15. And before Abraham was, I would add, Jesus said, I am. So Jesus is trying to connect himself, or connect the audience to himself. He is the great I am.
Well, at this stage, he's not embarrassed by his status as Messiah. He has claimed it in public now, and he has proven it by raising somebody who's been in a tomb for 4 days. So the culture could no longer ignore this man. And as a matter of fact, by raising Lazarus, he made Lazarus a target too. Target was in the sights of the Pharisees, and it's interesting that tradition has Lazarus not being killed, but actually escaping with one of his sisters to France. Now I don't know that history documents that, but that's the tradition, that he wound up in France after a stay over in I think Crete. That's a separate history, and it's outside the Bible. What we're concerned about with is the decision of the Pharisees. Okay, it's time to knock this guy off. Did they or did they not see him as the Messiah? And I bring that up because of Caiaphas's prophecy, assuming it was a prophecy.
Yeah, and let's get there, because that's over in chapter 12, actually. Mm-hmm. The plot to kill Jesus shows up in John chapter 12 with Caiaphas. It says, now a great many Jews knew that he was there, and that's Bethany, and they came not for Jesus' sake, but they might also see Lazarus. In other words, when Lazarus is raised from the dead, not only do people want to see the person who raised him from the dead, they want to see the evidence. Mm-hmm. And so the religious leaders actually want to not only kill Jesus for having raised the dead, but they want to kill the evidence. They want to kill Lazarus again. Now, if you're Lazarus, what kind of dirty trick is that? You know, you die, absent from the body, right, present with the Lord. And then what? You get resurrected only to be killed or to die again.
Wait a minute here. What is this?
Exactly. I mean, we look at this and think, oh, what a great thing. But if you're Lazarus, I mean, all of us, we face death once, you know, and then the resurrection. But for Lazarus, it's like he faced death, then the resurrection, then he faced death again, and then the resurrection again.
Lazarus 2.0. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He's died, you know, twice, and not many of us get the benefit. I mean, there's people in the Bible like Enoch who walked with God and was not, so he never tasted death. You got Elijah being taken up in the chariot of fire. He never tasted death. And then you got somebody like Lazarus who tastes death not once but twice. And anybody that Jesus is raising from the dead, like the little girl, Talitha Kumi, little girl, I say to you, arise. And then
widow of Nain's son. Yeah.
Yeah. So these folks are experiencing death not once but twice on this side of eternity.
So did the Pharisees accept him as Messiah or not?
Well, would you want to kill your Messiah?
If you look at Caiaphas and what he had to say. And he was the chief priest, and he said it's better that one man should die.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and you get this at the end of chapter 11, starting at verse 45, says, then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things that Jesus did believed him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. Then the chief priest and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what shall we do? For this man works many signs. Remember, the Jews seek a sign, the Greeks seek wisdom. And remember, this theme of signs actually runs throughout John's gospel. Jesus says, a foolish and perverse generation seeks a sign, and none will be given unto it except for the prophet Jonah. But then, of course, we get seven signs, and one of them is the resurrection of Lazarus.
So by saying that, he was saying the example will be given at the end, 3 days dead and then a resurrection, right? That's what he's referring to.
The ultimate sign is the resurrection. I mean, not that Jesus doesn't give signs, because he does. There are seven signs in John's gospel that Jesus does.
Saying he brought up Jonah because there was no precedent for being raised from the dead after 3 days after a crucifixion. So this is something that, and as a matter of fact, whether it was a legend or fact, Jonah being swallowed by a large fish and spit out, and the whole story of Jonah, even if it was just thought of as legend, the story remains the same, unchanged. There's this three-day interim that Jesus is saying, that's the sign that will alert them to the fact that I am the Messiah. So that had to be a reference to his time in the tomb.
Well, sure. I mean, and as if you needed another reference to or another sign to say he's the Messiah, because also the raising of the dead, the healing of the blind. I mean, we've got all of this, the healing of the sick, the multiplication. Here are the seven signs. You got changing water into wine, John chapter 2, the healing of the royal official's son, John chapter 4, the healing of the paralyzed man at the pool of Bethsaida in John chapter 5. You've got the feeding of the 5,000 in John 6, the walking on water in John 6, the healing of the man born blind, and the raising of Lazarus is the last of the seven signs and one of the I am statements. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. So Jesus does these signs, and the religious leaders actually say as much. They're concerned about this. They say, for this man works many signs. That's the end of verse 47. In verse 48 of chapter 11, it says this: if we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And one of them, and here it is, Caiaphas, who is prophesying here, and he doesn't even know it. He's the high priest that year, and he says, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider it that is expedient for us that one man should die for the people.
Okay, back up. How can somebody prophesy and not know it?
And not even
that
know
would make it coincidence, wouldn't it?
It's a God incidence. This man does not know what he's saying. He is thinking that he is going to save the temple system, protect the Jews from Rome, preserve the religious institution, kill Jesus, squash the hype, and keep on Temple Incorporated businesses as usual.
Point of order here, there were those Pharisees that believed into him, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, and maybe others, but they were afraid of the Pharisees, so they wouldn't publicly say this was the Messiah. Mm. What if Caiaphas knew this was the Messiah, that he had to die to save? And for he also refers to the Jews in the diaspora, the Jews who had been scattered throughout the Middle East and elsewhere through history. I'm thinking he knew this was the Messiah, and he was an instrument of the death that had to be. I mean, Jesus engineered his own death. It had to happen that way. That's why he was here. Did Caiaphas know that or not?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that he believes Jesus is the Messiah. I believe that if he thought for 1 minute that Jesus was the Messiah, he would not. I mean, you would not murder, you would not crucify the Messiah. So I believe this is selfish preservation of the religious system. You mentioned Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, secret disciples that come to Jesus at night. And we have themes of light and darkness throughout John's gospel. And John wants us to know that Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night, because later we're going to see at the crucifixion, right before sunset, Nicodemus comes with Joseph of Arimathea to take Jesus' body by day, right before the sun sets and Passover begins. They take his body down from the cross and lay it in Joseph's tomb. So we see Nicodemus coming out of the darkness and into the light. But here we see these men, like Caiaphas, walking in darkness. Their eyes are closed. They're blind. This, by the way, has just been an entire chapter that we've just kind of concluded in John chapter 9 of light and darkness, sight and blindness. And the religious leaders are blind, and Jesus is making the point by healing the blind man that they are the ones that cannot see. They are the ones that are blind. So I think Caiaphas is blind to who Jesus is. I think he's in the dark.
Is blindness culturally more significant in that culture 2,000 years ago than it is today? We see it as a huge handicap today, but was it symbolic of something else to the Jews?
Yeah, absolutely, that God doesn't like you. I mean, you see it in verse 1 of chapter 9. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? The Jews thought that if you had an infirmity of any kind, a sickness, leprosy, blindness, and by the way, I mean, this is Isaiah. When Jesus reads from the Isaiah scroll in the temple that the Messiah would, you know, the recovery of the sight to the blind, the Messiah would bring about the recovery of sight to the blind, he rolls up the scroll, hands it to the attendant, and says, today this has been fulfilled in your hearing. This is a sign of the coming Messiah, this recovery of sight to the blind, and certainly the resurrection is. And so Caiaphas sees this miracle, and he says, listen, everyone's going to follow him. Everyone. It's beneficial that one should die for the people and not the whole nation should perish. So Caiaphas assumes that everybody's going to follow Jesus and Rome is going to squash this revival and they're going to kill the people and they're going to take away the temple system. And then the text tells us in verse 51, now this he did not say on his own authority, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. It's a beautiful passage.
It just says to me he knew what he was doing. He prophesied in his capacity as chief priest.
Sure, but he was prophesying to the concrete reality that if they didn't kill Jesus, Rome was going to squash them. And so he was saying something on one level, but what God was doing was a whole nother level, because indeed, Rome would crucify under Pontius Pilate. Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and because of Jesus' crucifixion, he would raise from the dead the Holy Spirit, the same power that lives in us, that raised Jesus Christ from the dead, who also lives in us. How much more shall he give life to our mortal bodies?
This just occurs to me, and this is of interest to me, just all of a sudden. If we watch a movie and something surprising or odd or unexpected happens, we credit the writers. Boy, what a clever twist of plot that was. You know, I was entertained by it. But John, the Apostle John, chose to include that bit of information that Caiaphas had prophesied in his book. So what he said was, this really happened, and it's worth mentioning here. So must have been significant to John.
The entire road to the cross hinges on verse 53. The very next verse says, then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. They plotted to put Jesus to death from the moment Caiaphas says this. And then verse 54 says, therefore, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. So Jesus, again, is controlling when it is that he is going to go to the cross. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down. And so he sets into motion the plot for the Jews to take him to the cross.
Okay, here's a chronology issue for me. Mm-hmm. He went to Ephraim, and I had to look that up yesterday. It says the village was called Ephraim. In maps of ancient Israel, Ephraim is shown as kind of a region and doesn't pinpoint a village, but it would be north and east of Jerusalem several miles, and it overlooks the Jordan Rift, the valley. As I understand it, and this involves the story of Zacchaeus and the march up the Wadi Kilt to Jerusalem, before Jesus re-entered Jerusalem on what we call Palm Sunday. So he had to go, now this is not far from Jerusalem, he had to go back down to Jericho to make that trip. And now that trip is not related to us in the book of John. It's in the other Gospels, though. And he came up and he stayed at Zacchaeus' house, and he was with a group of pilgrims and with his disciples, and there was a sycamore fig tree and that whole thing. And Zacchaeus, by the way, played a significant role later that we don't know about, but he became a bishop of Caesarea in later years. So, I mean, as a tax collector, he was thoroughly redeemed by Jesus. How could that not have happened? Now, Jesus must have gone back down, and John doesn't cover that part because... boom, next chapter, we're looking at Palm Sunday. And he said, mm-hmm. Bethany. So where is that? John didn't seem to value that to the same degree that the other gospel writers did.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is the chronology of the gospels are, it's just not linear the way that we would, you know, read a novel from cover to back, because what you've got is you've got four different accounts of the same narrative, some of which leave some accounts out.
Four and different personal perspectives.
Yeah.
As if we're trying a crime and we have four eyewitnesses, you can get totally contradicting stories. But in the Bible, the contradictions can be explained. You know, in real life, you could still get four vastly differing stories given in a different order from different perspectives. And that's for the jury to work out. Here, we have to work that out.
Yeah, I'm not even calling there. And I wouldn't use that word, contradiction.
No, I'm saying if in the Bible you encounter a contradiction, the old philosophical saw is re-examine your premises, because it doesn't exist in real life. And this is real life. Contradictions don't exist.
Right. So, you know, just to put this these passages in context, the raising of Lazarus, you're talking about John chapter 11, verses 1 through 44. If you were to track the other gospels, the only other gospel writer that kind of gets us there is Luke. Luke has a long narrative of Jesus's life and ministry, and Luke was probably more comprehensive, actually synthesizing Matthew. Well,
he was a Greek, and I suppose that explains that.
Yeah, so you've actually got chapters, like Luke chapter 10, all the way through 18, that Luke has solo content that no other gospel writer has except for John in John chapter 10 and John chapter 11. So you can kind of track where Matthew and Mark go silent during those chapters, and then Luke and John are speaking and filling in the blanks. And then we get the synoptics picking back up with Matthew, Mark, and Luke in chapter 19 of Matthew, chapter 10 of Mark, chapter 18 in Luke, and then of course John goes silent until later on in the 11th chapter, starting at the 55th verse. So it's really neat, and what I would encourage your listeners to do is get a chronological study Bible. That particular tool is helpful to see the chronology of all of these events in their context. For instance, you've got the parable of the shrewd manager, the rich man and Lazarus, which is unique to Luke's gospel in chapter 16. You've got lessons of forgiveness and duty. And then Luke goes silent. And then you've got John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus. And then you pick back up with Jesus begins his last journey to Jerusalem via Samaria and Galilee. And that's in Luke chapter 17.
You can understand then why you and Preserving Bible Times are in the context business. Because just a straight reading of the Bible can leave somebody, leave their head spinning.
Yeah, a text without a context, a proof text for a pretext. We believe that context matters, and that we don't ask what a passage means to us until we first ask what it meant to its original hearers. the authors do not explain the chronology to us. They don't explain the religious context, the cultural context, the geographical context, the linguistic context. They just assume you lived when and how and where they did.
Well, that would say that the people who they were writing to had basically lived through that time and probably had internalized it. They knew it as if by heart. So the blanks weren't blanks to them.
I think I've heard it said so many times that the Bible speaks directly to us all the time, every day, word to word, and all the rest of that. But you know what the people who say that forget is that it wasn't written for us specifically. In a euphemistic sense, it was. But originally, it was written for the original hearers, the people on the ground, the folks that lived at the same time.
Hmm. Yeah, we have to, you know, the Bible's not going to give up its meaning to lazy people.
yeah, you got to work to get to it. I mean, right. And I'm looking at the same thing, and I listened to you a chronological study Bible, and I said, oh man, I wonder if I've got room for another book. I think I do. I may have to make room somewhere, but you know And I've wrestled with that same thing. I was looking at passages in Genesis last night while we were at Wednesday night service. And in just a couple of pages, my head was spinning. Hmm. I said, you know, this is confusing as all get out, you know, unless you look at the whole thing and look at it in context as the people who originally heard it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the West, I mean, it's been said that those of us who know the Bible well suffer for knowing the Bible well. We see what we know, but we don't always know what we see. So we've got to do the work and read these helps so that we can get our minds into the first century context. I mean, it's important.
I love the idea that the context explains what's between the lines and the white spaces. And it's been there all the time. This is not new stuff. This is not being injected into the Bible. It's explaining how that original audience would have seen and heard the same narrative at that time. So it's critical. Well, I want to mention the website that you could use. It's a great study tool. I mean, it's full of study tools. PreservingBibleTimes.org. They're in the process of converting all the books and things that, for example, Doug Greenwald has written. He was the founder of Preserving Bible Times. It's all being converted to digital, so you can acquire his books instantly with a download. They're PDF files, and they look just like the book does, except it comes down on your computer, your tablet, or your cell phone, and there are also videos there. Of teachings from Doug and from others. So that library is being revamped right now as we speak. So you want to make a note, preservingbibletimes.org can be just an important place. Put a tab on your browser for them. You can link there from our website at brokenroadradio.com. And Robbie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would take it a step further. If your listeners will just go over to preservingbibletimes.org, subscribe to our Between the Lines newsletter, then just go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Send us a private message in Messenger on Facebook, and I'll send you Chapter 9, The Raising of Lazarus from the Rest of the Story by Doug Greenwald. So Chapter 9, it's just a sampling of what we've been talking about today with the raising of Lazarus. If you want more, go subscribe to our website and like our Facebook page. Send me a message. Let me know you did it. And I will send you Chapter 9 of the rest of the
Robbie
story.
Robbie has just made you an offer you can't refuse. You should do that. PreservingBibleTimes.org. Robbie, thanks so much. We'll check with you in a week. We'll see what develops, where we go from here, but the Book of John is just rich ground to plow, and we'll look forward to whatever it is you bring us next Thursday.
Well, appreciate being with you. Wonderful to be with you, Jim and David. Have a wonderful day, gentlemen.
You too. Bye-bye.
You too, Robbie. Thanks again.